All right, I'll ask the marshal to open court then, please.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Flory, Judge Riley, and Judge Frisch, the Honorable James Flory presiding.
All right, and good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this virtual session of the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Our rules are the same as they always are, meaning you'll each have 15 minutes for your principal arguments, and counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes of rebuttal if you wish. Let's just check our sound to make sure everybody can hear what's going on. I see Mr. Gillespie, you are not muted. So why don't you say something for us to make sure we're hearing you okay?
Good afternoon, Your Honor. How's that sound?
Sounds good. How about you, Mr. Roll? I see you're muted, so there you go.
Good afternoon, Your Honor.
All right, good afternoon. So this technology has worked really well, but if something happens during the course of an argument and you can't hear something or somebody freezes up or something, raise your hand or get my attention and we'll try to correct the problem here and make sure that everybody has the amount of time they're entitled to here. Otherwise, as you begin your arguments, we are recording the proceedings as we normally would, even if we were in person. So please identify yourselves for our record as you begin. So with that, we'll start. This is Gillespie Law Offices versus State Farm, court file A201133. Counsel for appellant, you may proceed when you're ready.
May it please the court, my name is Pat Gillespie, Patrick R. Gillespie, and I'm going to be appearing and arguing on behalf of the appellant in this matter. Facts of the case are pretty straightforward. Appellant law firm was hired by an injured person who was injured in a motor vehicle collision to represent her for all claims related to that collision. The retainer agreement specifically said the law firm was retained to represent the client for all claims arising from the incident. That would include claims for no-fault benefits under the Minnesota No-Fault Act, including benefits for medical expenses for medical treatment. The respondent, State Farm, was advised of the representation and did not object that the law firm didn't represent the client for this claim. The law firm then filed a petition for arbitration when there was an inappropriate delay in paying medical bills by the respondent. Under Minnesota law, under the rules of the No-Fault Act, that filing a petition commenced a no-fault action. The petition itself that commenced the action indicated the amount to be claimed was $10,000, which is the maximum allowable under jurisdiction under the No-Fault Act for arbitration. The record or the rules also require additional documentation be submitted with the petition. And that documentation did indeed admit that medical bills that had been incurred exceeded $10,000 at that point in time. But that was not part of the petition, strictly speaking. Strictly speaking, the petition is a document that's indicated in our appendix. The respondent, State Farm, filed an answer to the petition. Which did not agree to arbitrate anything over $10,000, but made no objection specifically to either the itemization in the petition or the supporting documentation indicated medical bills that exceeded $10,000. The parties exchanged discovery requests during the course of the arbitration proceeding. And during that proceeding, for no apparent reason, State Farm made payments for medical bills that were disputed in the arbitration directly to the medical providers, neither the law firm nor the injured person authorized those payments. After those payments were made, the parties realized that those issues were no longer in dispute, and so the arbitration proceeding continued on to what were disputed between the parties, which were some medical expense benefits that had been incurred after the filing of the petition. Ultimately, there was an arbitration hearing held, and the arbitrator found in favor of the client for the appellant and awarded wage loss benefits to the client. State Farm, the respondent, paid that arbitration award. It did not attempt to appeal a district court to vacate the award or make any protest about the award. There was no claim that the action had not been commenced or anything else. The award was paid. The law firm then commenced this action to secure payment for its lien on attorney's fees pursuant to Minnesota Statute 481.13. The respondent initially filed a third-party action against one of the medical providers claiming unjust enrichment because the provider had been paid the bills that had charged the injured person. The district court ruled against the respondent on that claim, and that ruling has not been appealed to this court.
So, Mr. Gillespie, that third-party complaint also had an indemnity and contribution claim in it. What happened to that claim?
The court ruled against them on indemnity contribution, indicating that State Farm had no basis to make that claim.
What order is that in? Where did the court rule on the indemnity claim? Where is that in the file?
To be honest, Your Honor, it is implicitly, I guess, in the court ruling, in the opinion denying our claim for attorney's fees and sustaining the claim against State Farm for unjust enrichment. It didn't specifically indicate indemnity, to be honest with you.
Yeah, are you still representing Woodlands Chiropractic?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't hear you.
I'm sorry. Are you still representing
Woodlands? The representation of Woodlands ended, Your Honor, with the court's order in this case, but I suppose strictly speaking, if Woodlands had a indemnity claim against them, we still be representing them. But at this point in time, there's no claims pending against them for indemnity.
So, all right. That seems a little problematic. I guess it's not part of this case, but if there was an indemnity or contribution claim against them, that would be for your fees that presumably had been paid to you then by State Farm. And it just seems problematic.
Well, Your Honor,
represent Woodland.
There's 100 years of case law, Your Honor, that basically indicates that if a defendant does pay a claimant or anybody else without the attorney's consent during the course of representation, the defendant is responsible for the payment, and that does not create a claim for contribution or indemnity. And the claimant is not discharged for on the attorney's fee.
So this is Judge Riley.
District Court, Your Honor.
Just a minute, Mr. Gillespie. I just want to understand what you think would happen if you were to win all the way around. So if, as I understand your argument, State Farm should not have paid the $20,000 in attorney's fees unless you got your contingency fee out of that? Is that what you're arguing?
What State Farm should have paid is $20,000 that was due on the no-fault claim. And then between the client and the provider and our office, we would divide up the money according to our fee. Just as if State Farm had paid an injured person for on a personal injury case $20,000 and cut out the plaintiff's lawyer or a medical provider.
So now you think that since they paid out the $20,000, I'm just trying to understand what the remedy you're seeking.
Yes.
So since they paid out the $20,000.
The remedy we're seeking is our fee.
From whom?
No, the remedy we're seeking, Your Honor, would be the remedy on our fee, would be our fee on the $20,000 according to our retainer agreement, which is a third of the $20,000. So it's closer to $6,000.
let's call it 6,000 for purposes
666 and 67 cents.
Or 7,000. But who do you think should pay that to you now?
Oh, State Farm has to pay that, Your Honor. There's 100 years of case law that says that if a defendant pays the wrong person, they have to pay again to the lawyer's fees. I mean, the Williams versus Dow case is basically goes back and reviews Minnesota case law regarding that issue. And there are some really difficult situations for defendants in those kind of cases where they have been, they either paid the wrong person accidentally, or one time they're even tricked by the claimant and they pay the claimant directly and turns out there's a lawyer after all and they still have to pay. So, I mean, the law is crystal clear that a payment to a claimant or a third party does not discharge an attorney's lien in Minnesota.
Counsel, can I ask some questions about the retainer agreement? It seems to me that
yes, Your Honor.
On page 10 of your brief, you cite some authorities for the proposition that the agreement between the attorney and the client sets forth the parameters of the attorney lien, right?
It sets forth the parameters of our representation, yes, Your Honor.
And therefore, that's the And those would be the terms under which a lien could arise, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So then when I look at the retainer agreement, it provides that your firm is only entitled to the amounts, quote unquote, recovered, quote unquote, as a result of the arbitration. And 5 minutes ago, you said that the amounts were paid by the insurance company for no apparent reason. So that doesn't seem to me to be an amount recovered as a result of an arbitration proceeding, or at least there aren't any facts in the record that would indicate that. So what's the basis of the lien here?
It's an amount that was being claimed in the course of the arbitration, yes, Your Honor. And the retainer form may not be as specific in terms of specifying fees on amounts that were claimed and paid to third parties, because that's not something that normally happens, I guess, in the normal course of representation of parties. But the attorney's lien statute does indicate we have a lien on the cause of action as well as the arbitration proceeding. And the cause of action, nothing else would be a lien for 20 grand. I didn't come up below.
But the authorities that you cite indicate that the scope of your lien is defined by the retainer agreement, right?
The scope of representation is defined by the retainer agreement, yes, Your Honor. The lien is a statutory lien. We can't define what the legislature says is the scope of our lien. The legislature has established what the scope of our lien is. Our retainer only establishes what the scope of our representation is and what our fee would be.
But in your claim, I'm looking at that, it said addendum 11, your total amount claimed was $10,000, but then you amended it when you before the actual arbitration, as I understand the record.
Your Honor, it never got formally amended. What happened was that is a customary of the case here. The petition is filed and the action's commenced, but there is a gap between the date of commencement and the date of actual arbitration hearing. Generally, that's about 3 to 6 months, depending on scheduling. And during that 3 to 6 month period, customarily, clients incur additional losses, such as wage loss or medical bills, and the arbitration hearing takes into account all claims that have occurred, have accrued, between the date of filing and the date of hearing. In this particular instance, what happened was that providers billed State Farm as required to under the Kice case. So State Farm knows what is coming at them and therefore they're liable for interest if they don't pay under the No Fault Act. So the providers kept paying, or kept billing, I should say, State Farm, and eventually State Farm, for a reason they'd never stated, just wrote a check to the providers for the amounts due. And that's how we got, that was an amount that was disputed in the arbitration and therefore should have been paid over to the law firm to be divided according to the agreement between the client and the provider and this office.
But as I understand it, when you file a claim that's going to go through arbitration, there's a ceiling of $10,000.
There is a jurisdictional ceiling of $10,000, is correct, Your Honor. If it's over that, however, the case law is clear that the arbitration can proceed. And likewise, it's also clear in the case law under the Hippie case and the Brown case that even if you have bills over $10,000, that doesn't force you out of arbitration, that just that the amount of your claim is the amount you say your claim is in the petition, which is in this case $10,000. I'm about to run out of time, Your Honor. I have a number of other things to say. I'll briefly say that I think the action was properly commenced under the statute. In our view, the district court didn't properly review the criteria for waiver and its decision that the law firm waived its claim for fees is not supported by Minnesota law. And the court should therefore reverse the district court and order it to enter judgment on behalf of the law firm for the amount of the lien, which is one third of the $20,000 that was paid.
All right, thank you, Mr. Gillespie. Your time is up. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you wish. Counsel for respondent, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Patrick Rohl, R-O-H-L. And I have the pleasure of representing State Farm Insurance Company today. Thank you for your time.
So let me just ask you right off the bat here, Mr. Rohl, responding to Mr. Gillespie's comments for benefits paid under the No Fault Act for medical benefits. Are those normally paid directly to the law firm if one has been involved and you have notice of it, or are those paid directly to the provider in the normal course?
Well, in the normal course, benefits are paid directly to the provider unless the attorney involved has provided a notice of an attorney's lien or the payments are involved with an arbitration, resulting from an arbitration.
Is it your position that you had no notice of an attorney's lien in the matter?
Well, I think it's undisputed that there was no formal notice of an attorney's lien.
Is there some authority that says that has to be filed with you?
I believe that there is. I guess it's based off of Minnesota Statute 48113, which is the implied attorney's lien. I'm not aware of any statute that says there can be a lien if a party doesn't know about it and isn't involved in any ongoing litigation.
All right, go ahead with your argument.
So at issue argued by Mr. Gillespie here is that his law firm established an implied lien by filing a no-fault petition. What actually happened in this matter is that his firm set forth a claim which advised that he was seeking $10,000 but included $10,821 in medical bills. Our office, on behalf of State Farm, filed a response, a Rule 5 response to that petition, which expressly objected to mandatory arbitration for any claim that exceeded $10,000 and which was not itemized pursuant to Rules 5 and 6. Rule 6 advises that if a claimant intends on arbitrating a matter with bills that exceed the $10,000 jurisdictional limit, those bills must be identified within 30 days, the bills that will not be included in order to obtain jurisdiction. Well, 30 days came and passed and no bills were ever identified as part of the claim. And it's State Farm's position that the bills actually weren't overdue at the time of filing. And so when those bills did become due to the medical providers, State Farm issued payment to those providers because there was nothing involved in any arbitration because the AAA doesn't have jurisdiction over claims in excess of $10,000. It was unclear which.
Didn't the petition itself, though, say the claim was for $10,000, but that the itemized receipts totaled in excess of that? But by filing a petition for $10,000, didn't that limit their recovery to that amount? To that amount?
Well, it technically, in theory, would limit their recovery to that amount. The rule is clear that if more than $10,000 is claimed, those must be identified. And the reason for that is because, of course, without that rule, someone could set forth $16,000 in bills and be a lot more likely to get a $10,000 award for that. And what's been decided apparently is that only $10,000 in those bills can be set forth in order for that forum to have jurisdiction over the matter. So State Farm issued the payments to the medical providers, never did get an amended claim from Gillespie's office until a few months later, at which time they set forth a claim that was within the jurisdiction of the AAA, and that was a wage loss claim. So that claim obviously did not involve any medical expense benefits. State Farm then agreed to move forward with that claim in arbitration, defending that as they're required to. And that arbitration ultimately took place over wage loss. And there was an award issued for a certain amount of the claim. And Mr. Gillespie received his fee from a third of that award, I guess. And now he's requesting a third of the additional $20,000 that was paid prior to any arbitration that commenced, because an arbitration can't commence until $10,000 in medical bills have been identified specifically.
Mr. Roll, do you agree that prior to the petition for arbitration being filed, that State Farm received notice of the Gillespie firm's representation and acknowledged notice of that receipt?
Yes. And so I guess moving forward with my argument, the appellant in this matter has taken portions of the applicable statute and the applicable rules and tried to use those to bolster that case. If you look at the appeal, the brief that appellant submitted to the court for the appeal for this matter, and you look at page 6 there, if you look at the legal issues presented, the legal issue number 2 states whether an implied attorney's lien was perfected pursuant to Minnesota statute 48113 when it filed a petition. And then it states the district court held, without explicitly deciding, the district court concluded that the arbitration action was commenced and therefore the lien was perfected. Well, if we look at Judge Mahler's order on page 6, she sets forth the correct law, which is the implied attorney's lien at issue, 48113. Two sentences later, Judge Mahler writes, the medical expense claim never proceeded to arbitration. She goes on to say the medical claim never involved the employee of the plaintiff. In other words, the plaintiff failed to take the requisite actions necessary to commence an arbitration for the medical expense benefits, which was necessary.
So Mr. Roll, I was gonna ask a question about the judge's order about whether or not these benefits were paid in the employ of the appellant law firm here. Is that a fact question, or is that a question that can be decided as a matter of law? Because this case was disposed of, obviously, on summary judgment. But whether something was, whether these fees or amounts were paid to the provider in the employ of, or during the employ of the law firm here, would seem to be a fact question that that shouldn't be decided on summary judgment. How do you respond to that?
Your Honor, I believe that that statement is taken from the analysis of the statute above, which requires there an action to have commenced in order for the employ, which triggers the implied attorney's lien.
Counsel, an action is typically commenced with a pleading setting forth what the claims are. And in this case, the thing that is the pleading did contain a claim for medical expenses. I mean, here's where I am concerned. It's that the plaintiff's attorney was retained to pursue all of these claims, which were unpaid by the insurance company, and then was forced to bring an arbitration action and included all of these claims. And then the insurance company decides only after that arbitration action is filed to pay at least a portion of the claims. So I find it difficult to believe that the plaintiff's attorney's involvement in the action, at least at some level, is completely divorced from the payment by the insurance company, or at least, as Judge Flory says, there's a fact question there.
Your Honor, as I had indicated previously a little bit, the benefits had not become due at the time that the petition was filed. The claimant involved here was not a State Farm insured. State Farm had not received an application of no insurance and whatnot. Within these bills weren't 30 days overdue. So it's the insurance company's position that the petition was prematurely filed. And at that point, okay, well, we have to kind of wait and see what happens. We'll move forward with it. There was never any amendment to it to make it within the jurisdiction, and then those were paid. So this isn't a case where these bills were unpaid for a year or two, they hire the law firm, and then all of a sudden the payment's issued. And it wasn't a portion of the claim. State Farm exhausted the medical limits paying these bills, which allowed for the law firm to bring a wage loss claim that they wouldn't have been able to bring to the no-fault arbitration because it would have exceeded the jurisdictional limits at the time. So somehow we get to this where the appellant is now seeking a third of the $20,000, despite having set forth only a claim for $10,000 that $821 that never accrued, you know, that was never amended to accrue anything, and which allowed for the wage loss claim during which was, you know, for wage loss that was backdated, some of which I believe occurred prior to the filing of the petition. And those claims would never be able to proceed to arbitration had there been this initial arbitration that that the appellant claims there was.
So, Mr. Roll, following up on your argument, can you point me to a statute or a case that supports your claim that you just made that this petition was prematurely filed?
Sure. So it's not only a statute. Obviously, there was evidence submitted with that, but it would be, I can give it to you here. Rule. Let me look at the, it's on the, it's, I believe it's rule 5E. Pulling pulling it up here now. Well, actually, it's a 65B rule that says that medical benefits are not overdue until 30 days following the insurance company's receipt of those benefits, or a reasonable proof of the fact and amount of loss realized. And this is an argument that was addressed in an early memo to the district court, which argued that the insurance company didn't have reasonable proof of the fact and amount of loss realized until A, it had received the bill, and B, it had been provided documentation that would indicate that State Farm was the responsible no-fault insurer for this matter. Mr. Gillespie's client was not a named insured under a State Farm policy. Pulling up that exact statute for you. Your Honor, do you have any other questions related to that other than the statute?
I don't. And you have about 30 seconds here, Mr. Roll.
Okay. That would be 65B.57.
All right, then. Thank you, Mr. Roll. Mr. Gillespie, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. This is an action that was filed pursuant to Minnesota Statute 41.13 subdivision A and has to be decided on that basis. Mr. Roll's argument has gotten way far afield of the facts that were presented to the court below, or even argued with the court below in terms of premature filings and that sort of thing. The simple fact of the matter, Your Honor, is that section A of 41.13A indicates that the attorney's lien commences when there's been a summons, well, when an action's been commenced. The no-fault arbitration rules indicate the action's commenced. That's Rule 5C by filing of the petition. That commences the action. Even Rule 5E that Mr. Roll refers to indicates that after it's been commenced, they have 30 days to specify if something's being waived, but it's still been commenced. The fact that ultimately there may have been a claim that State Farm could have pursued saying there's no jurisdiction and the matter should be dismissed does not affect the fact that it's been commenced. If that were the case, if no jurisdiction meant no commencement, we could be in a circular world where I could refile because it's not been commenced and get another judge perhaps to help me out and say there is jurisdiction this time, but if there's none again, it's not been commenced. So therefore I keep filing because no jurisdiction means no commencement in State Farm's world. That's not the way it is. Commencement and jurisdiction are two different things. If I file a summons a complaint and the district court has no jurisdiction, it's still commenced. And that's what triggers the subdivision one of section 481.13A to create a lien for attorney's fees on a claim. The claim itself was for medical bills, and at the time of the commencement of the action, they were $10,000, but they became more as time went on, just as if I filed district court action and I have some wage loss, but I keep having wage loss between the date of filing and the date of trial. There's still an additional claim that builds up, and the claim at trial is the wage loss to that date, not to the date of filing. And if a defendant were to pay an amount to settle a injury claim directly to the claimant and to bypass the lawyers. Under the Williams case, they'd be obligated to nevertheless pay the lawyers out of their own pocket for not protecting the lawyers in the case under their lien. Parenthetically, in preparing today, I thought I did miss something that I probably could have argued earlier, is that subdivision 2 of the same statute gives plaintiff's attorneys a property interest lien in a claim that's not been filed. So even if the claim were commenced, there would still be a attorney's lien on the cause of action, which is a property interest under the City of Orinoco case, where in that case, the claim wasn't filed, but the lawyer still had a lien on the cause of action, even though it wasn't filed or commenced. In any event, the decision here has to be based on the attorney's lien statute. And under that statute, the lien existed because we were retained to represent the client on that claim. And the amount of the claim became liquidated once they paid it and recognized it. So the amount of our fee is stated on the amount that they paid, which is the amount of the claim, which was a liquidated amount when they paid it. And therefore the proper decision here is that the statute requires the defendant to honor the attorney's lien and pay the attorney's lien or pay the fee stated in the retainer agreement.
All right. Does that conclude your rebuttal then, Mr. Gillespie?
Yes, it does, Your Honor. Thank you very much for your time.
All right. Well, thank you, counsel, for your briefing in the matter and the arguments here today. We'll take the matter under advisement at this time, and we'll have a decision in the matter within 90 days.